The first meeting of the Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs Committee for the 2005 biennium. I'm Kathy Singlestead, and honored to be your chair for this committee, and honored to have all of you here today. And we're going to actually start out with member introductions. And I know there's several things in your folder. We're going to kind of go through those after part of the meeting here, because we have some honored guests for our initial testifiers here today. So if you want to just grab your agenda, members, pull that out, and that shows what we'll be doing here in the next couple of hours. But to start with, I'd like to have members do introductions, and we're going to do these fairly quickly. But if you could give your name, the communities you represent, and then what connections you have with Veterans Affairs or Military Affairs. So a family member, or maybe, I know we have several veterans on the committee here. I think that will be helpful not only to our presenters today, but also to me as chair and other committee members, as many of us have personal interest in the issues that will come before our committee. So I'd like to start with my vice chair here, Dan Severson. If I'm looking for name, communities, and your connections with Veterans Affairs.
Good morning. Pleasure to be on this community. I'm Dan Severson, represent Stearns, Benton, Sawchell, Sauk Rapids, that area. I'm 22 years. I was full Navy fighters, and I have a son that is currently serving in Afghanistan for the last year with Minnesota National Guard.
Thank you. Let's go with members. We'll come back and get staff. Representative Peterson.
I'm Neil Peterson. I represent Bloomington and a little bit of Edina to keep me humble. I have absolutely no experience other than garage logic about military affairs.
Okay. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lynn Wardlow, and I was in the Marine Corps and Marine Corps Reserve for 29 years. My son is a captain in the Marine Corps. He flies Cobras. And I sit next to the sailor over here sometimes, but he lets me. And I just love the military, and I wish I was still active. Okay.
Representative Mike Nelson from Brooklyn Park. My son just finished a six-year term in the Navy. He was on a nuclear sub. I have a brother that spent 20-plus years in the Army, retired as a major. And that's about all. I didn't serve myself.
Great, thank you.
I'm Representative Sheldon Johnson, Southeast St. Paul. I have a very active veterans members in my district, and the only other thing really is I played American Legion baseball.
All right. And I'm Diane Loeffler. I'm honored to represent Northeast Minneapolis, and my connections also are more distant. Although the Northeast Minneapolis Armory is in my district, and I have had the privilege of working with people who have been Guard members and have worked closely with Milton Schoen, who's the Veterans Service Director for Hennepin County.
Okay. Hello, I'm Tina Liebling. I represent part of Rochester, roughly the southern part. My dad is a World War II veteran. That's about my only really close connection with the military. Of course, I have a lot of veterans in my district.
Great. I'm Joe Hoppe from Chaska, Chaska and Chanhassen. I did not serve in the military because I am a chicken. But I have my father and other family members did, and I'll do whatever I can to help.
Great.
I'm Lloyd Seibert. I represent Apple Valley Burnsville. Did 20 years active duty Air Force. The reason I joined the Air Force is because the Army had a commercial at the time. We do more before 9 a.m. than most people do all day. And the Air Force guy told me that we get up at 9. So
and luckily, our committee doesn't start till 10:15. So good. Let's move to this side of the table here.
Hello, members. My name is Andy Welty. I represent the communities of Plainview, Elgin, Stuartville, Chatfield, Dover, Eota, and the fringes of Rochester. And my experience with the VFW, it actually goes back to the VFW and the Legion. My grandfather was very active in our local VFW and Legion, and he was a district commander. My dad was a Legion member. And there are many, many active Legionnaire members within my district. So I'm very pleased and honored to be serving on this committee.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Leon Lilly from North St. Paul, Lakewood. A lot of service organizations in our area, so I'm very honored to represent them, and looking forward to this, quite excited. My grandfather was on USS Ward, and you see the big cannon out there at the end of the mall area. So.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. I'm Representative Mike Beard from Shakopee, Prior Lake, and the Midwakanton Indian Community. I've never served in the military. I had a little stint in the Civil Air Patrol in high school. My youngest son, however, just mustered out of 4 years in the Marine Corps. My cousin Bradley gave his life in Iraq in November. Mm-hmm. And my uncle Larry, who's now a state representative in New Hampshire, oh, by the way, was a West Point grad and 27-year Army veteran.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Danny Magnemar. I live down in Hastings, and I've never been in active military or in any of the military. My father's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army National Guard. I do represent in my district at the Hastings Veterans Hall.
I'm Jerry Dempsey, RA 1741358. Sir,
we're impressed. Wow.
I can remember when it was in date. Could I just mention one little experience I have in the Army?
Represent Dempsey.
I was a ground pounder. That's the infantry. I can remember we had long chow lines. Get from our barracks up to the chow line, and this was in basic training, and I'd been there for about a week. And I went down and saw the first sergeant, and I told him, "Sergeant, I only have about 5 or 7 minutes to eat chow, because the lines are so long, and we had to do pull-ups before we could move on to the next stage." And I said, "You know, I'm standing in line and standing in line, and it just doesn't seem to work out. Haven't you got a better system than that?" And he said, "Private, you don't like to stand in the line?" I said, "No, sir, I don't." He said, "Well, then stand in a circle." So I got the information real quick as to not question what I was told to do.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Ruth Johnson. I live in St. Peter and represent areas of North Mankato and small towns in Niklet County and in the southern half of Sibley County, where many members of our communities are currently involved in military service. My father was a supply sergeant in the Army Air Force in World War II and served in New Guinea.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Representative Aaron Peterson. In my second term, I represent 5 counties in the west central southwestern part of the state, 31 small towns, the largest being Benson, 3,400 people. I don't have any formal ties to the military, but I'd like to thank the military representatives and the National Guard for the troop send-offs that occurred throughout the summer and into the fall this past 2004.
I'm Phyllis Kahn, and my district is right around the university and in the center of Minneapolis. My father served in World War II behind the running a field hospital behind the, there's a doctor, beyond the Battle of the Bulge. And for any of you people who have elderly relatives, please talk to them, because it wasn't until I saw Saving Private Ryan that I realized that I should have had some much more serious conversations with my father about what that experience was like. My own personal experience with the military-industrial complex was that I worked on the design of the M16 rifle as a student intern in the summer at the Frankfurt Arsenal in Philadelphia, and every time one of those misfired in Vietnam, I cringed and worried if it was some miscalculation that I had done. And I've served on this committee and the finance, this committee for quite a while, but more importantly, the finance committee that handles those appropriations. And I was looking around the guys that are sitting there, and I realized there's no one left that we can tease about the fact that it was our committee that devised the tuition reimbursement. In those bipartisan days, it was suggested by a Republican, one of the most conservative Republican members from Redwood Falls, Howard Miller, if any of you know him, and we all took it up and we pushed it against their tremendous protest. They did not want that, and we made them take it, and since then it's been apparently the best recruiting tool that we have. And there are some adjustments that I want to make, probably more in the, I don't know if it will come through this committee or in the state government finance committee, but I think we all appreciate what the National Guard and the military has done, and I think we ought to be terribly concerned about what's happening to them at this time.
Thank you, Representative Khan. And Representative Khan is the lead DFL on this committee. And I also want to mention Representative Marty Seifert isn't here, and I know there's a couple other members that have been excused today, but Representative Seifert chairs the State Government Finance Committee, which is the finance division of our policy committee here. So he serves on our committee, and it'll be vital as we move things from policy to finance that he's very involved in this. And just quickly, my background, I represent the Anoka County communities of Andover and Coon Rapids, very near the Anoka Armory, which is very active in our area. And my father served in the Korean War and was in the Marine Corps, and I have a couple of nephews right now that are in the service overseas. So. And I see we've been joined by Representative Olson. If you'd like to introduce yourself, your communities, and your connections with any military or veterans issues. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Apologize for being late. I represent District 16B, which is entirely within Sherburne County, minus the three corners, Big Lake and a portion of Elk River and small Becker, where I grew up. It's now big, along with Big Lake and a few other townships and smaller communities. I have quite a number of relatives from the military and had a strong influence in my upbringing in that regard. Missed the boat with the Vietnam War with my generation. Came at the tail end, but beyond that, I had a strong influence from my family with regard to the military and serving, and look forward to serving on this committee again. This is where I started back in 1982. So, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right. Great. Thank you, members. And I'd like to have the staff do the introductions. And I have to tell you that you'll get to know my right and left hand here very much soon, with Scott Neske being my committee administrator for this committee and Alicia Davis being the committee legislative assistant. So I'll have each of them introduce themselves, but these are two people that you need to get to know through our committee process here. Scott, Mr. Neske.
Scott Neske, I'm the committee administrator. My dad served in the National Guard here in Minnesota, and I have a number of friends that are recently enlisting themselves. So last year, I don't know if anybody was on the Commerce Committee. I can't remember. I was the Commerce Committee Administrator last year. So I'm a little new to the GovOps area too myself, so hopefully I'll be hitting the ground running here too. So thanks.
Great. Davis.
Alicia Davis, Committee Legislative Assistant. A number of great uncles and grandparents have served in the military, served our country, and just recently had a cousin return from Iraq.
My name is Jim Cleary. I'm from House Research. I'm a former Marine and Vietnam veteran. I enlisted in the Marine Corps right out of high school and had to learn a whole new terminology. Excuse me, right out of seminary in high school. our son is currently serving in Iraq with the Minnesota National Guard. Members, I handle Veterans Affairs for House Research, and that's in the past it's been a relatively smaller part of this committee work since you handle so many areas. Mark Shepard in the audience here is the regular analyst for this committee for all of those other issues, but I'd be happy to help you on Veterans Affairs military.
Great. Mark, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Sure. I'm Mark Shepard from House Research. I'm a legislative analyst that works with all the issues in this committee other than the veterans and military issues that Jim works with, and I look forward to working with you.
Okay. And our committee page, Brooke, where is she? Like to introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Brooke Peterson.
Where did you go to college?
I went to St. Paul State.
Other staff members.
Bob Chipman, House Republican.
Brad Kelly, House DFL Research. And as far as connections to the military, my father did serve in World War II. He flew B-38 in that office. And I very privileged to work with members.
Good, welcome. Did we miss anybody? Other staff people? Great. Well, welcome. With that, we'd like to transition over now to our first testifiers. I think it's apropos that we start with the military affairs. And joining us today is Adjutant General Larry Chaletteau and Colonel Dennis Shields. And I believe they have a presentation. So welcome to our first committee meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Figlestad. First of all, I'll give you a little background on myself. I joined the military in 1968. Either join or be requested without a choice. I'm a 3-year veteran of active duty. I'm a Vietnam veteran, combat veteran. And in 72, I joined the National Guard and have been in the National Guard since then. To include my last tour of 4 years as a division commander of the 34th Division, which was Minnesota, Iowa, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and elements in Michigan and Missouri. In November 3rd, the governor appointed me the adjutant general, and so I left my civilian occupation. I was president of Alexandria Technical College. I'd been there for 37 years, the last 9 years as president. So I have a very strong interest and background in education, and I consider the Minnesota National Guard as one of your leading educational institutions in the state of Minnesota. With that being said, with me today, I'll just introduce them, and they can introduce themselves later at a different time, is Brigadier General John Trost. I brought him on board as part of my team. He is an educator also. With him is Colonel Danny Shields. Prior service, active duty, and has been with him. You probably know him as the voice of the Minnesota National Guard because he's either on radio or television or something, but he's doing a lot of that. Third is Terry Palmer. Terry Palmer is my full-time expert, and he pretty much runs in anything that is specific to the state. Terry takes care of. And both, you should have the cards of both Colonel Shields and Terry Palmer in your packet. You should be given a packet, which is our annual report. One of the initiatives that I'm stressing very strongly to let people know as much as they can about us. And then you have also a printout of the slides that I'll be showing for your convenience and questions. Because of time constraints, I ask if you would hold your questions till the end. I would really appreciate that. So we'll go on. The second slide that we have is just what I'm going to be talking about. I'd like to spend a lot of time on why the Guard is different, because I think that's one of the questions your constituents are going to ask you quite often. And then you'll go through what's the organization or impact, federal, state, and community missions. I'm going to talk some about issues that are in the news that you hear about, that your constituents are calling you about, and I hope to answer those, and then we'll have follow-up questions afterwards. I want to talk about Minnesota's support to the National Guard, and then more specifically what will be our 2005 initiatives. If we take a look at why the Guard is different, the most common, there's a couple things. Well, what's the difference between the reserve and the active duty? Then, in turn, what's the difference between the reserve and the guard? And simplistically, it would say, the active duty, and you're going to hear some titles, I'm going to call it Title 10, is when the governor and through them people join and they leave home and they're on active duty, they're at stations, and they perform at the will of the President of the United States. They are answerable to the President of the United States and his delegated authorities, i.e. the Department of Defense, Department of Army, Marines, and so forth. As they do that, that's it. They've left Minnesota. They're gone for 3, 5, 6 years and come back. Then we have, and they take an oath, by the way, to our Constitution and to the President. What's unique about the Minnesota National Guard is they take two oaths. They take the oath that is to the President of the United States and to our Constitution, and then they also take the oath to the governor of the state of Minnesota and to the Constitution of the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota National Guard is the state's on-call, ready reserve asset to do emergencies. Right now, in the United States of America, there are 842 National Guard soldiers deployed somewhere. We have 439 soldiers in Indiana, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Kansas just dealing with winter storms. We have two still on duty with the Florida hurricanes. We have one out of Arkansas that's dealing with the tsunami. We have 19 in Texas giving rabies shots. And we have 361 guarding key assets all across the eastern part of the United States. Interestingly enough, the number one news item that's occurring right now is the floods of California, and there's only two activated. Because we are the second level of defense for the state of Minnesota. As you know, with Homeland Security and with the, like say, the Minneapolis or St. Paul police departments and fire departments, they are the first responders. And they, only when they decide that they need assistance, will call the governor for use of the National Guard. And at that point in time, it's the governor's decision as to whether or not he will deploy us to do a state mission. With that, he also takes on the obligation that all the pay and allowances that are associated with us being activated has to be taken care of by the state of Minnesota. However, that is the only asset that you have available to you. So if we have another flood fight of 97, excuse me, which we had over 3,000 Minnesotans deployed to protect both the Minnesota and Red Rivers, it's up to the governor. Next slide. We are basically broken down. Now, let's point out this way. It's in the federal government's best interest to have a ready reserve available. That's why they created the Army Reserve, and that's why they fund the National Guard. At the national level, the command authority said, I need a strong air force, but they're expensive. I need lift assets and I need fighter assets. So if you were to fly up to Duluth at the air base, you have the 148th Fighter Wing, F-16. If you were to go to the Minneapolis airport, you will see the 133rd Air Wing, and there they do airlift. And they were one of the first overseas. In fact, they were the first U.S. Plane to land in Iran after their earthquake. On the National Guard side, we need a strong force, and we are the home base for one of eight National Guard divisions, the 34th Infantry Division, which has a great historical lineage. With that, they also have a number of specialty units, and we put them under an umbrella called Troop Command, and then we have a 53,000-acre facility by Little Falls called Camp Ripley, which we want to get each and every one of you there to see. It is the best-kept secret in the state of Minnesota. It is a jewel in both for military training, but also for the environment. We're very, very pleased with that. And then because of all the issues and the technologies and the need to combine and communicate, we have a joint force headquarters that we have created, and that's, as you see on the slide, 461 people. Now, what does that mean? What is the federal government's commitment to the state of Minnesota? They're pumping in over $300 million to make sure that we have this force ready so that should the governor, or excuse me, should the president, i.e. through the Department of Defense, need those soldiers, he can call them up. Now here is a significant point, because you're going to get a lot of constituents calling you saying, well, what about this, what about that, and oh, by the way, I want you to do something about it. Once they leave the state of Minnesota, once they are activated, the only avenue of approach that I have, the governor have, that you have, is the power of jawboning. We can complain. We can make an issue of it. We can't make them do it. Yes, you can make them wish they did. But that is a key, significant thing. Once I stand on stage and they hand them, and I hand them the deployment order and they are activated, they're not mine anymore. They're not the governor's not anymore. They're not yours anymore. So that's just what I wanted to say. But in turn, the federal government gives us $300 million annually to make sure that they can do that. Now, we've gone through an era over a long period of time where we've never had to do that. Also, we like to say that the Minnesota National Guard is one of your agencies where we probably pay more in taxes to the state of Minnesota than we receive from the state of Minnesota. I think there's a delta there of about $4 million. We haven't totally proven that yet, but we're confident. Continuing on. Also, what's different between the reserve and the guard is that the state has a significant investment in facilities that they own. We have 63 training and community centers, or armories, if you will, located all across the state of Minnesota. The metro being the largest concentration of them. However, I will tell you that these training centers are economic engines to rural Minnesota. And oh, by the way, they are conveniently and co-located with major issues. For example, I used to be the commander up in the Northwest region. And every spring, we would watch and monitor the snowfall because the Red River had a bad habit of going over its banks. And we just had a standard battle drill, and those units up by the Red River, that you're going to get called on, you better know how to sandbag. Also, we kept in our armories our then 113s, now the Bradley fighting vehicle, because there would always be a snowstorm and someone would be driving going east to west on Highway 2 up there and get stranded. You'd be surprised in the history the number of times we've pulled people, not in the last couple of years, but I'd get a call. We've been not activated, we've just gone out because the Highway Patrol said we have people stranded and you got the biggest snowmobile around. So, but also in southern Minnesota, etc. So I just point that out. It's just quite outstanding. Next slide here shows, and I just want to talk about the issue, depending on your age, you will run into constituents that will, well, I remember the guard when, you know, and that has totally changed. We were, really prior to 9/11, considered to be the weekend warriors. And that is what the Constitution and the federal government is designed to support us to be. I want you to be trained and ready, and we will fund you for one weekend a month and 15 days during the summer. And that's what we lived it. We did very, very well with that. Well, over 40% of the force being deployed as we speak is out of the Guard and Reserve right now. Jim Cleary's son is walking the streets of Baghdad as we speak. And so we have become an integral part of the Air, Army and Air Force. You've heard a lot from your constituents. If you haven't, you will be, about the number of deployments that they are making and the stress that it's having on the families and so forth. Again, we represent 40%. We're engaged worldwide. And we have, and what has been said by national leaders is this country cannot or will not go to war again without the Guard and Reserve. This is absolutely significant if you're to do the sociological study. When we deploy soldiers, if you've been there, there's a ratio of at least 5-1 in the audience versus those being deployed. And when you send those soldiers, the family and the community goes with them. And that's the significant difference. That's not, I'm a Vietnam vet. When I left town, no one knew I left. When I came back, they asked, hey, where you been? I haven't seen you for a couple weeks. I was gone 3 years. That is gone. Everyone knows where they are, what they're doing, and they get nervous when they listen to the news. Next slide shows you that we are in, Minnesota National Guard since 9/11 has been in over 30 different countries. If you count them up, I think you'll get 24, so don't worry about that. There are six more out there. kind of interesting, but you see that star in the middle of the Indian Ocean? That's Diego Garcia. And it was unaffected by the tsunami because of just the geological construct of that. They had deep waters all around it, so it didn't have a big wave. They're safe and they're sound. There is no problem. Our federal mission. Since 9/11, immediately at 9/11, first of all, the Air Force was called out immediately. They capped or flew over Minneapolis-St. Paul. They flew over the Pentagon. They were active. But in 2002, we had 375 of our people either guarding the airport or flying over the airport. In 2002, the Guard had mostly air. In fact, all air was 324. But now you start to see the shaping of all of a sudden the Iraqi war was starting to come to fruition and so forth. The Afghanistan went in very well. The Northern Alliance took up. That was the ad hoc reserve, if you will. All of a sudden going into Iraq, the Guard, first of all, picked up what we call the supporting missions. We were scheduled going to Bosnia, and Minnesota was the lead state in taking care of Bosnia. And then the fourth ID, which is an active duty, which is an elite mech brigade, or division, was to be one of the leads along with the third ID, and they were scheduled for Kosovo, so we pulled, and Minnesota picked up the Kosovo mission also. So during 2003, we had 3,648 people out of Minnesota deployed, both air and army. And then, now as we currently speak, we have 1,607 that are deployed. So since then, we've had the 5,954 Minnesota Army and Airmen that have been deployed somewhere away from home. Right now, the coin of the realm, the two big deployment areas are Afghanistan and Iraq. Representative Severson, I will be flying to Afghanistan next week. I'll be there for 5 days. I hope to see your son. And then hopefully in the April, May time frame, I'll be in Iraq, and I hope your son is home by then. Jim Cleary is an excellent source, but also he made a mistake. The only error I've ever seen him made. He said I was a Marine. You all know, once a Marine, always a Marine. One of the questions that some people had asked that was in the news was, do you have enough people back home, you know, to do state emergencies? And even though we've had 5,900, we have a total of 12,800 people, so there's plenty that are back, but also there's just the flow through. As people are going out the door, other people are coming back into the door. So we started out just having deployment ceremonies. Now we're going to both deployment and redeployment or coming home ceremonies. I just went to one in Mankato where the community of Mankato and then Blue Ridge County honored the troops that were in Kosovo and had a little ceremony for them. And it was kind of interesting, too, but probably the classic example to talk about is the Florida National Guard, one of the first into Iraq, did an outstanding job, came back home. They were told, that's it, you're going to rest. And then they immediately went to work with four hurricanes. So they had both federal and state. They were both federal mission and state mission quite extensively. Very quickly going through these state missions, in 2002, the state of Minnesota called upon 1,095 mandates. And we searched for a lost hunter. We did firefighting by Brainerd. We did natural disaster relief in Norman and Roseau counties. Flooding. 2003, we had 3,140 days. We searched, assisted in Stearns County for Josh Brumman. We helped secure facilities in Dakota, Washington, Sherburne, Ramsey, and Hennepin counties. We did firefighting in Swift County. We did natural disaster relief in Renville County. And we prepared for a state strike, and we were doing training in snow plowing. And then in 2004, we had 1,195, which was involved actively in the Drew Shedin search, nuclear power security, airport security, and then fire suppression. We have training plans, for example, and in the next slide to continue on. We also had what we have created because of the issues. We were concerned about the four or five major events, the National Democratic Convention, the National Republican Convention, the election and the now the inauguration are all key, what we consider high-profile, high-impact type of scenarios. So we were actively involved. In the state of Minnesota, you have our operations center operating 24/7. We've been doing that for an extended period of time. We have on-call with a four-hour notice, quick reaction force of two elements of 75 young soldiers each.
and then another rapid reaction force, which is available within 24 hours. Basically, they're not sitting anywhere per se, but we have a fine-tuned call tree and so forth, and they have their gear and their trunks, and if they're needed, they'll be here very quickly. That's our commitment to the state of Minnesota and through Homeland Security. Community missions, we have built, because we have a three-part mission, federal, state, and community. We have documented 34,567 hours of service, and we're very, very proud of that. Most recently, if you would have been over to the training center on Cedar Street, you would have seen us working with the Salvation Army, distributing all of their toys. And it's a great training exercise for our logisticians, forklifting and everything else. And then Camp Ripley is with their environmental program. We do job shadow with the high school students. And we're also the training site for the Highway Patrol and the Department of Defense. Now, in the news, there's some of the things that people may ask you about. Body armor and armored vehicles are two of the big ones, especially with that Rumsfeld interview and the soldier from Tennessee. Have they been an issue? Yes. Will they be an issue? Yes. However, I will tell you that the military system and the supply channels are working extremely well. I have personally never been given, nor have my people been given, complaints other than on the body armor, they have it. I just was out to Fort Dix. All those that are going into Iraq are fully comfortable with the equipment and the stuff that they have been issued. You will see on this slide, and there's a quote, the company commander that just went into Iraq, here's what they fell upon. They fell in on they have brand new M11, the 14s, the heavy Hummers, and armored security vehicles, full body armor, and they're basically impressed with what the equipment they've got. You may have heard stories, for example, when our troops were in Bosnia and Kosovo, they did have some up-armored Humvees, and they were taken away from them. Well, there hadn't been an incident in Bosnia and Kosovo where all of a sudden the insurgent forces adapted to the U.S. tactics and started using something that people just weren't prepared for, and that was big improvised explosive devices with 155 and bigger rounds. And if you watch the media right now, it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because as we've gotten more armor, they've gotten bigger. In fact, I was reading just recently in the lexicon and linguist, there's new terms they're adding each year. The hot term right now, the one that was elected, was the red, blue, and purple states because of the election. But there's another term that was being considered called hillbilly armor. Hillbilly armor is all that armor, the scrap metal that people were gathering to send overseas. Okay? And that's true. I could bring in the tag of North Dakota, and he was saying, yeah, that is true. That has happened. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. But just be careful when they say, what are you going to send them? Because if it's not hardened steel, you may be creating more shrapnel than you are protection. So those are the things there. Lengths of deployment are going back and forth in the news, but most of the literature I'm reading from people quoting Rumsfeld, et cetera, is it's going to probably stay, and you'll hear the term, 12 months boots on the ground. The clock starts for most of our deployed soldiers when they enter country when they leave. That's the 12 months. Now the sad part is if it takes them 6 months to get them ready to get in country, that's probably the national issue. We had some that have gone as short as in the start. Charlie won 42nd on Little Falls. They were gone in a week, some of them. That's too short. But again, we're committed to make sure they're well-trained as they go in, length of deployment. And then the D word. Anyone know what the D word is? You'll hear in the media, we're going to have the draft. We're going to have the draft because we're still. I will tell you, if we go back to the draft, we might as well just stop. You know, I mean, you know it conventionally watching sports teams. They have one bad apple, it ruins the team.
Mm-hmm.
I am a product of a draft-induced military. I fought alongside draft people. Some did not want to be there. And I never want to be put in a command situation again where I had to task some of my people to watch some of my own troops.
Mm-hmm.
This is an all-volunteer army. It's an outstanding army. You have the finest, best-educated soldiers in the world. And most all of them join to get a college education. That's number one. But I tell you what, I have yet to have anyone say, hell no, I ain't going. Did I have people not want to go? Of course not. I once asked a couple of them, you hear all these people saying how great and wonderful it is that you're serving your country. What do you feel about it? Because what my thought was, well, if you're so great about that, why don't you go and take the place? But they don't. They go. They do well. And I tell you, they are just truly outstanding. And any time I get into a point of just being down, I go visit the troops. In fact, I wish I could take this committee to visit the troops. You would be in awe, and you would be, you just would. You just leave it at that. Minnesota's support for the military and the National Guard has been absolutely outstanding. The First Lady's initiative, family support group, has grown beyond all our expectations. A couple of real quick anecdotal. We had a car dealership out of Hastings that helped raise $20,000 to help support soldiers that are with B Company, the unit out of Hastings. We had a contracting company that didn't have a lot of money, but they had time and talents. They said, give me two families, I can help. They went in on a Saturday and fixed the garage door, fixed this, fixed that, doing outstanding. The Military Family Foundation, when I started, we had about $3,000 petty cash. We're well over the $300,000 mark. We've been able to send parents to see their son or daughter or their spouse in a hospital. We've helped the young people out of Southwest Minnesota come home for Christmas. We're doing a lot of things. The professional sports teams have been very, very good. To include all that discussion we had about the G.I. Joe doll with the twins, you know, but the Vikings and so forth, we've gotten more ink, national media, thanks to them. The media embeds have been just super. It's easier to get the media. In fact, we have one that we're working to get over there now as we speak. But that's absolutely, and if you listen to Jeff McKinney or John Hines coming back, they both have said it's kind of a life-changing experience being around these young men and women. And I want to point that out, young men and women.
Mm-hmm.
We deployed one unit that's currently getting ready over there that will be 40% women. And then phone card donations, very quick and easy, but the Postal Service, starting over at Diamond Lake, they have given us 15,000 phone cards. The lowest end was $10, so forth. Now, I'll speed this up. Initiatives, as you know, the governor is funding 100% tuition. Again, it's the number one reason people join. I will tell you right now, the Minnesota National Guard is leading the nation in recruiting. Okay, we're very, very fortunate there. And they have a lot of benefits that the same as us. So it's not that. It's just, for some reason, could be as simple as the water. I don't know. But we are doing it, and we're doing it very, very well. We're very, very concerned about our mid-year term leadership, because they'll be the future leaders of the Guard, and we're looking for a reenlistment bonus for them. There's a couple of smaller ones, state active duty, those that have been activated, that would be tax-free. It's a small amount, but it's there. And then we have a conformity to a Federal Military Family Relief Act is just to make, if there is a death gratuity payment, it wouldn't be taxed. That's basically it. Initiative you're probably, that we have as an agency that you'll have seen more likely in this committee. We want to carry forward authority for maintenance in our facilities. This is a housekeeping, I think is the term you use, but basically it's to allow us to, you know, it's that old mentality of use it or lose it. We want them to make good management decisions and say, all right, with the tail end I've got this year plus the funding I get for next year, I can accomplish the objective right away. So that's kind of the goal we want with that one. Army board language, It just allows our enlisted soldiers to serve on our Armory Board. Right now, the language says it must be a commissioned officer. And as all you know, the enlisted are probably the smarter bunch of the group, so we want them included also. Lease language, just the authority to rent the facility. It's a little dispute we have with the legislative auditor. We want to make Camp Ripley not necessarily a profit center per se, but at least a cost reduction center, and this would allow us to do that. And then again, we have a situation where retiree language, we'd like to take a look at that. And what I want to be able to do is, current language says, I have a, let's say I have a person who retired from the Guard, and say it was an E7, Sergeant First Class. But I was also worked for a major computer corporation for years, and I want to hire him. And he says, yeah, you can hire me, but I'm only authorized to bring him back at his old rank. You know? And I will tell you that I have soldiers that do their drill that on the M-Day side make 2 to 3 times the money that they do. So it's just some language things. Take a look at it. But that's where we're at. Now, what I've told you is the objective side of the Minnesota National Guard. And what I'd like you to do is take two and a half minutes at the most. And I want you to watch the monitors. And I want you to what we are experiencing on a regular basis. Okay.
I'm just trying to be a father, raise a daughter and a son, be a lover to their mother, everything to everyone. Up and at 'em bright and early, I'm all business in my suit. Yeah, I'm dressed up for success, from my head down to my boots. I don't do it for the money, there's bills that I can't pay. I don't do it for the glory, I just do it anyway. Providing for our futures, my responsibility. Yeah, I'm real good under pressure, being all that I can be. I can't call in sick on Mondays when the weekend's been too strong. I just work straight through the holidays, sometimes all night long. You can bet that I stand ready when the wolf growls at the door. Hey, I'm solid, hey, I'm steady, hey, I'm true down to the core. And I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, bear that cross with honor, cause freedom don't come free. I'm an American soldier, an American. Beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front lines, sleep in peace at night. American soldier, I'm an American soldier. Yeah, American soldier, an American.
our things said, this is your Minnesota National Guard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very inspiring and a really unifying message there with the video, so I appreciate it. Members, we have several things on our agenda, but I think I'd like to take about 10 minutes and offer the opportunity of just one question per member if you're interested now, knowing that we'll have some of these folks back from the Department of Military Affairs as we hear bills throughout the session. So with that, I'd like to open it up for questions from members. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Could you just tell me briefly, what are mandates? I wasn't clear on what a mandate consists of.
Senator Shelton?
Chair Tanglestead, Representative Johnson. A mandate is one-person day. So if I had 100 people working one day, that's 100 mandates. Or one person working 100 days, it's 100 mandates. So it's a sum total of a day's pay times the people. I hope that clarifies that. So when we talk about this, I think that was with your state active duty slide, or the state active duty slides. So we probably had 100 people on for 10 days, maybe at an extra, that type of thing.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, sir, you clarified well the distinction of the dual oaths and identified how once they are commissioned to go under the federal authority, that they're gone and no longer under yours. Aside from that, has there ever been a case that you've experienced where the dual focus and the dual oaths come in conflict?
Chair Sokol?
Chair Bannister, yes. And that's actually, it's a nationally addressed issue. There's three, the G8 Summit, the Democratic National Convention, and the Republican National Convention. All were examples where the G8 Summit, the Florida National Guard, commanded active duty soldiers. Title 32, which is the Guard of the Reserve, and Title 10, which is the active. The same in Massachusetts, the same in New York. And they all did special legislation, one-time stuff, and they're trying to make that even more clear, because as we get into homeland security issues and bringing together who's going to be the commander on the ground. But in essence, for the state, at the individual soldier level, there'll be one or the other. But it's a real strange paradigm being addressed, because it's the active. I'm here now, so I'll take over. Well, you don't do that. You don't come to, for example, if we had a major national tragedies, of the, not the magnitude of the tsunami, but very large. We have excellent medical facilities in the metropolitan region, but there is an element of medical specialists available to fly in here and assist. Okay, they will be federal, but they will fly in to assist. They don't come in and take over. These are life-threatening situations. So these are things that are being discussed all the time, because in the old days, we had the active army, they took care of all this stuff, and nowadays, with 40% plus being reserve component, they can't do that anymore. So, yes, we've had some experiences.
Question from Representative Kahn.
Thanks, Chairman. I'm interested in the issue which I read about recently, and that I started to talk to.
Representative, if you can pull your mic down.
Okay. And that's the question about the problem that the tuition reimbursement program has come into, with the fact that people were enlisted because of it, are signed up for it, are then deployed for, I guess, a year, and then when they come back, they're no longer entitled to it because their term is over. So they haven't had the ability to use it, and that was the reason why they signed up for it. And I guess unless they re-enlist, they don't, under current circumstances, they don't do it. And I certainly looked at that and thought, well, the obvious thing is we clearly ought to extend it for the amount of time that they were deployed.
Yeah.
And the question is, what your comments are about that, and do we need to do that? Is that law or your rules, or what's?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, that's interesting. Very
right now, I think the it's law, I think, is the issue, and you can change law. But the key right now in the state's tuition assistance program is that you must be a member of the Minnesota National Guard. So what Representative Connors, I think, is referring to is, let's say I joined for 4 years, my four-year degree, and I'm way through, and I use up 2 years in deployment, and I need a five years to get my four-year degree. Well, they lose. If they leave, right now, if they leave the Minnesota National Guard, yes, they would lose it because they don't meet that gate of being a member of the National Guard. You can change that. The other question, though, the caveat with that is some people say, well, I served 6 years, therefore I should be getting, and then the word entitlement comes into play, I should be entitled to 6 years of education. And I would disagree with that a little bit. I think if you were to extend it, then I would say, well, put a sunset clause in there that says, yes, okay, but, I mean, it's your dollars. It'll help me, but in turn, I wanted then an incentive to keep the stay in also.
Huh. Quick follow-up, Representative.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm interested in the really very narrow issue of the people who are deployed and sent out of the country.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in that extension. I don't think I'm interested in an unlimited extension, but that just seems patently unfair at this time.
Yeah.
And I would agree.
Okay. Question from Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General Salto, I was curious of all the young men and women that are soldiers in the National Guard, what percent are actually going to school part-time or full-time maybe in the, doing the National Guard? How many kids are doing
President
that?
President Wardle, Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Wardle. We've been researching that extensively, and it's a very fluid number, but Terry, help me here real quickly because he does all the number crunching for me.
It's really just about 20% of the force.
Yeah, if you could just repeat that.
20%, roughly about 20% consistently. And again, if you take a look at it, you know, with the 12,000 and the entire rank structure and so forth, you'll see a lot of them will go through. In fact, if I could show you statistically, and that's why this retention initiative is also important. They have an obligation for 6 years, and they'll join. And at that 6 year point on our retention, you'll see a spike. Because it's mission accomplished, they came in, they did what they were expected to do, they achieved their personal objectives, and we salute smartly and say thank you for your service. So that's why those numbers keep turning over, and that's why that percentage would be lower than you think. But I will tell you also, the National Guard, and Minnesota National Guard in particular, is probably one of the best educated workforces in the state of Minnesota. To include the fact that we have been asked to promote among our members job opportunities because they like the fact that they're trained, they're disciplined, they're educated, they're drug-free, and they both know how to respond to leadership and be a leader. So we're finding that. I never thought of that as us being an employment agency, but it's starting to be that a little bit.
We have time for one final question. Oh, a follow-up, Representative Ward, real quick.
Thank you, madam. I wonder, once they've got their degree, how many of them apply for officer candidate school? And continue on to be an officer?
Actually, our numbers have been growing extensively on that. We have about three or four different options. The most popular one is being what we call the 501, which is kind of like the old World War II shake and bake. They've got their degree, they've got NCO experience and so forth like that, and they'll go off for over the summer and get it, and then they go off to their commissioning school. But he's referring to basically, though, to be an officer in the Minnesota National Guard, you have to have or gain very shortly thereafter a four-year degree. That's a minimum standard.
Representative Liebling, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. General, I wonder if you could just give us a really quick idea of some of the demographics of the people who are serving, like their average age, how many are women, where are they from around the state, if you have sort of general statistics on that.
Okay. General, you know, I see these numbers all the time. We have 12,800, roughly 10,400 or 500 are on the Army side. the other in the air side. We are statistically representative of our service areas with most of the population groups. Minorities are a little tougher, not so much for African American, but for the other, the newer minorities that have come. They still tend to be a little more closed, if you will. With that, a ratio of female to male, I think it's going to be 15% to 20% female. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you know, John, you're...
I think it's probably a little bit less than that, sir, but that's very close.
And one of the driving factors for that is we are the home base of the 34th Infantry Division. And most of the slots or job positions we have are restricted to male. We have, however, designed our structure to be more supportive, and we have detachments, or little pods, if you will, in various units. For example, as commander of a mechanized infantry battalion up in Moorhead a few years back, it was all male. However, with Moorhead and Fargo, with Concordia, Moorhead State, North Dakota State, and so forth, we have an unbelievable pool of females that wanted assistance. So we visited with the signal unit out of the metro area, out of Hastings and so forth, and they put a company down there. And within a very short period of time, we filled it. And it was almost entirely female. And because they want the college benefits also. So we're looking very carefully on the force structure, if you will, to create positions that have opportunities for females.
Thank you very much. I think with that we'll conclude this part, and thank you very much, Adjutant General Shelto. And remember, members, we've got some contact information that they gave you, and we'll have some bill hearings where we'll have various staff people in, and feel free to contact them in the meantime. So with that, I think we'll move on the agenda. Thank you, gentlemen and ladies. Lady, thank you. The next up is Department of Veterans Affairs overview. Mike Puglisi, who is the acting commissioner, and members, I'm hoping that you're still planning on staying through the whole committee time today up until noon, because after this presentation we'll go through the committee rules and some other special things that we have planned for Thursday this week, and then we're going to conclude before noon there with a brief presentation by Jim Cleary. We'll be moving Mark Shepherd to our next committee time. So with that, I'd like to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Severson and proceed with the agenda. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Puglisi. I would ask that you would give your name and title for the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mike Puglisi. I was appointed Acting Commissioner on December 6th. With the retirement announcement of Jeff Olson. I'm also a Marine Corps veteran of the Persian Gulf War, and it's a pleasure to be here before you today and provide an overview. I know time is of the essence, so I'll read through my presentation. If you have any questions throughout, just please feel free to interrupt me. If you want me to get more in-depth on a topic, please just stop me and ask. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today about Veterans Affairs, who we are, what we do, and what plans we have for the future. I'll keep my remarks brief and give you a very general look at the department and then answer any questions you may have. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs was created in 1943 to meet the needs of Minnesota's veterans, their dependents, and survivors by assisting them in securing those state and federal veterans' benefits to which they're entitled. We accomplished this mission by providing overall leadership and direction to the veteran community, as well as offering many forms of benefits and services. Veterans Affairs is a small agency where more than 60% of our appropriation goes towards direct benefits and services to veterans. We currently have 35 employees, which are divided between our claims office located in Fargo-Moorhead, our claims office located in St. Paul, our State Veterans Cemetery located in Little Falls, and our headquarters office located in the Veterans Service Building. These four offices serve the over 460,000 veterans of Minnesota, their dependents and survivors, with the assistance of the 105 men and women who comprise the Corps of County Veterans Service Officers, as well as the assistance of the representatives of Minnesota's congressionally chartered veterans organizations. The department's fiscal year 06 and 07 biennium general fund budget is $7,976,000 and is broken down into three programs. the benefits program, the services program, and the operations program. I'll mention each one of the services found under each program area, but will only expound upon a few of the more significant ones. The benefits program, which comprises 45% of our budget, or $3,564,000, provides and oversees financial assistance, the County Veteran Service Officer Operational Improvement Grant Program, the County Veteran Service Officer Certification Process, Veterans Preference Enforcement, Educational Assistance for Veterans, and the Homeless Veterans Program. Financial assistance to needy veterans comes in the form of direct emergency financial assistance to veterans, their dependents, and survivors. Provisions are for shelter and utilities, optical and dental benefits, and cash grants for food and personal needs. The County Veterans Service Officer Operational Improvement Grant processes and allows County Veterans Service Officers to apply for and receive a grant from the department to help improve the services and the efficiency with which they provide those services to their county veteran families. Veterans Preference provides veterans a limited preference over non-veterans in hiring and promotion for Minnesota public employment. It also provides protection against unfair dismissals and demotions and grants veterans the rights to a hearing prior to dismissal. Our Homeless Veterans Program provides homeless or at risk of being homeless veterans and their families with services such as food, shelter, needed medical programs, and links to all veterans benefits. The Services Program, which comprises 18% of the total budget, or $1,746,000, includes claims representation, fiduciary guardianship services, and veterans outreach. The claims offices located at Fort Snelling and Fargo-Moorhead provide direct claims representation before the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the Board of Veterans Appeals to maximize the amount of benefits and services received by Minnesota veterans, their dependents, and survivors. In federal fiscal year 04, our claims offices were successful in obtaining over $180 million in direct payments to Minnesota veterans and their dependents through the federal government. In addition, many Minnesota veterans also receive millions of dollars in medical care through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs medical centers as a result of our claims office's efforts. Our guardianship program provides financial case management services to incompetent veterans, their dependents, and survivors who may be vulnerable to exploitation by others or by their own inabilities to manage their funds. The goal of this program is to assist the guardianship clientele in maintaining a lifestyle as independent as possible. Our operations program accounts for 38% of the budget, or $3,151,000, and includes the duties and responsibilities of the Commissioner's Office, the Bronze Star Grave Marker Program, information technology, the State Veterans Cemetery, planning and fundraising for veterans' memorials, the Military Discharge Repository, the State Approving Agency, and the recently separated Veterans Program. The Bronze Star Grave Marker Program provides a Bronze Star Grave Marker to the survivor of a veteran, which is used to mark the veteran's gravesite over Memorial Day weekend. The State Veterans Cemetery, located near Little Falls, has been open for the interment of veterans and eligible family members since 1994. Over 1,450 interments have taken place during that time. A federal grant of $3.6 million was recently received for renovations, which have made our cemetery one of the most attractive veterans cemeteries in the United States. Veterans receive a free burial with free perpetual maintenance of the gravesite. The department has also become the state repository of military discharges for all military members returning to Minnesota. We safeguard these important documents and provide them to the veteran when needed free of charge. The State Approving Agency has a mission to provide the administrative oversight of the GI Bill's Minnesota education and training programs. And the recently separated Veterans Program is a collaborative effort with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. When veterans separate from active duty, if they identify Minnesota as their home of record, the department will receive their discharge papers from the Department of Defense. Upon receipt of their discharge papers, information including a welcome home letter and relevant transitional information will be mailed within 7 working days. Besides thanking these fine young men and women for their dedicated service to our state and nation and welcoming them home to Minnesota, we will be providing them with helpful information on veterans' benefits and services, as well as Department of Economic Security programs and services. This letter also directs them to their local county veteran service officer where they can receive additional services and assistance. All budgeting, financial transactions, human resource management, affirmative action maps, and CM4 transactions are also processed within the program. Now here's a number that may surprise and hopefully impresses you as well. Over $1 billion per year in federal veterans benefits is provided to Minnesota veterans and their dependents. in large part due to the collaborative efforts of the department, the Corps of County Veteran Service Officers, and veteran service organizations. Although these numbers are extremely impressive and among the highest in the nation, I believe we can do better, especially in the area of assisting minority and female veterans. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, minority and female veterans are less likely to seek and obtain the veterans' benefits and services they are entitled to. As a result, countless go without, many of whom are in desperate need of these valuable entitlements. We therefore have recently expanded and improved upon our methods of outreach by taking services to the veteran communities with a particular emphasis aimed at communities of color and female veterans. We are currently working in cooperation with local county veteran service officers, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, veteran service organizations, social service agencies, shelters, religious organizations, as well as community leaders and organizers in our efforts to connect with this underserved segment of Minnesota veterans. Assisting these veterans to make maximum use of federal benefits will not only increase the amount of federal veterans' benefits received by Minnesota veterans, while reducing state spending for services which will be provided by the federal government, but will also greatly enhance the quality of life for many of these veterans. We hope to continue with this new approach and vital program, which has thus far proven extremely successful. In addition, with the advent of the global war on terrorism, comes an increase in the overall number of veterans, especially disabled veterans, returning home to Minnesota. We are working closely with our friends at Military Affairs, as well as the County Veteran Service Officers in all 87 counties, to ensure that these men and women, upon returning home, receive whatever assistance they need. And basically, our primary goal with this is to make sure that the veterans returning home at this point are being treated better than the veterans that returned home after Vietnam, World War II, and the Persian Gulf War. And thus far, they are. Before closing, I would like to provide a couple of updates and then field any questions that you may have. As most of you, if not all, are aware, the governor included $670,000 in his bonding proposal for the completion of the Minnesota World War II Veterans Memorial. We hope that both the House and Senate will once again support this proposal. If so, we are hoping to break ground as soon as possible this spring with a dedication ceremony tentatively scheduled for late September. To date, the department has been successful in raising over $500,000 for the memorial, in large part due to the generosity of the Minnesota veterans organizations and community. As a result of the current state deficit, the department does not have any major initiatives this year, nor do we expect to see a large amount of legislation concerning veterans this session, with the exception of some possible special license plates for select veterans groups, possible bonus bills, and World War II memorial funding bills. I believe you may also see a bill that would allow the sale, of the Big Island Veterans Camp at the end of this legislative session. The camp is owned and managed by four veterans organizations who, for several reasons, desire to sell it. And lastly, I have recently been asked by the Agriculture General Legislation Veterans Affairs Senate Committee to provide a report on the framework and potential numbers of those eligible for a bonus to Minnesotans that have served or are serving in support of the global war on terrorism. I'm awaiting some final numbers from DOD, and upon completion of gathering all the relevant information, we'll be happy to provide this committee a report as well. In closing, I would like to thank this committee for their past support of Veterans Affairs. I look forward to working with all of you, and once again wish to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the Department of Veterans Affairs with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Pugliese. This is a whole bunch of information that's going to be hopefully digestible as we go through the rest of this session. And I would encourage your department as well to not look at the budget deficit as a showstopper here. If you come up to the table and ask, that's the first step. And I think there are many things that we can do for our veterans in this state who have really given huge sacrifices for our freedoms that we are enjoying now and need to be there at the negotiating table. Any members from any questions from any of the members?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, in the Veterans Hospital, have you solved the problem for veterans so that there isn't a long waiting line to be receiving the medical treatment that they deserve?
Mr. Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, the VA medical centers are run by the federal government. We are working with them to help them solve the problem, but we only have so much influence. They have done a pretty tremendous job in cutting down the waiting list. The specialty clinics is where you're going to find the major problem. In eye care, some orthopedics. Those are where the clinics have a lengthy wait, sometimes of a few months. They've done a very good job here in Minnesota, and we have one of the best medical centers here in Minneapolis as well as up in St. Cloud. They've done a great job with the resources provided to meet the needs of the veteran community here in Minnesota. But it comes down to a funding issue. They're not receiving enough funding
to have enough staff doctors at hand to serve all the veterans. But with what they have, they do a tremendous job, and we are still working with them to improve upon that.
One more question. We have time for one more question. Representative?
You mentioned that veterans that get out of the military and have their home of record as Minnesota. What about the veterans that get out that don't have their home of record in Minnesota but choose to live in Minnesota and work in Minnesota? Do you have any type of program to track those, or are they identified when they do get out?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a way to track their 214. Most individuals, when they get out of service, are told by their command to go ahead and bring it to their county recorder and have it recorded as well. Hopefully they do that. Some don't. Actually, a lot don't, and wind up needing it in the future. If they don't select us as a home of record, the DOD doesn't send it to us, so we won't have it. So hopefully they do go home and record it with their recorder. If they don't and they need it down the road, there is a way to track it. The Department of Veterans Affairs, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, does have it. They maintain all discharges. I'm not sure if all of them are currently maintained, but down in the St. Louis Regional Processing Center. So we can write or call down there and have them look up people's discharge papers and get them that way for them as well.
Thank you, Mr. Iglesias. I really appreciate your testimony. We look forward to having you here in front of the committee numerous times this session.
I look forward to it as well, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, members, we're going to do a little bit of organizational stuff here with the committee before we have our last testifier. And so if you want to pull out your folders, and there's a couple different sections in there, what I'd like to go through real quickly here is our plans for Thursday, our list of members here, and then also the committee rules. Let me just start with the list of members. And we had even a change on our committee membership as late as 5 o'clock last night, so we're hopeful that all of you are here to stay now. So if there's any typos or any errors in this sheet for your room number, your LA, your phone number, please let Committee Administrator Davis know about that. You can just mark it up and give it to her here before we leave the committee, and we'll make sure and get that updated. Next, I wanted to talk about the schedule for Thursday. And I've been able to catch some of you on the House floor to mention this to you, but I just want to go through this real quickly. Our normal committee meeting dates are Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday during this time frame. And Thursday, I thought we'd do something a little bit different. I'd like to meet with each of you kind of member to member individually during our committee time. So instead of you obligating yourself for 2 hours on Thursday, you only need to be available for 15 minutes. And you can see I've scheduled times with each of you. And if it doesn't work, please let me know. But we tried to set it up so that I start at the fifth floor and kind of go down through the state office building here. And also, Committee Administrator Neske will be following me. So I'd like to start with Neil Peterson right at 10, and I'll talk to you for about 5 minutes, 7 minutes or so. Then Mr. Neske will come in your office, and I'll head to the next one. So we're going to kind of hopscotch around here on Thursday. But basically, for your information then, if you can be available during that time so we can meet quickly. But between now and then, think of the information. I'd like to go through the three questions on the bottom of the sheet. In those few minutes together, I'm interested more in your background as it specifically relates to this committee. And then any of your specific areas of interest for the committee, what ideas you're kind of thinking about or maybe need some help with or have questions on. And then the last is what do you hope our committee accomplishes? So I think this will give me some good information as a chair and something to kind of help us steer through the next 10 weeks or so on this committee. Mr. Neske, was there anything in particular that you wanted the members to think about when you go around and meet with them? Okay. I think it's basically so you start putting a name and a face together with the committee administrator. Question, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're going to come to our office?
Yes.
So I just need to make sure I hang out that 15 minutes and you'll show up?
Right. That'd be great. And in fact, if you can just bring this piece of paper to your LA right now so she has it on the calendar for you, that would be really helpful. Actually, with that, Representative Demmer, I don't believe you were in the room when we did introductions. If you can just quickly do that, your name, what communities you represent, and any kind of connections you may have with Veterans Affairs personally or family member. I want to just take a minute to do that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Randy Demmer. I represent, I'm starting my second term, Republican from Dodge County and Western Northern Olmsted County. For those of you who don't know Olmsted County, where Rochester is, I cover a little bit of the city of Rochester, a lot of small communities. My school districts range from small and slightly declining to fast growing. And I guess my interest in this committee, primarily, I had a brother-in-law who was in the Air National Guard for a long time. In fact, he was a wing commander. He's retired now. He's a major, I guess. That's my connection militarily. My father served in World War II and has very strong feelings about the military, so that's an interest. I also have an interest just in government operations and the things we do with state agencies. So excited to be here for that reason, and thank you for the chance to talk.
Thank you very much. Okay, members, I'd just like to take a minute and go through the committee rules, and actually, if you have any questions specifically about this, if you could just talk to me later. Most of the committees have just a real basic set of rules, and it's kind of information for you and any audience members or other people who visit our committee, and it's pretty basic. You'll see that most of the committees have very similar committee rules. The main thing, number two there, make sure and let Ms. Davis, committee legislative assistant, know if you're unable to attend a meeting. If you want to be marked as an excused absence, we need to know that ahead of time. So your LA or you personally can just talk to her and let her know if there's something coming up where you know you're going to miss a meeting. We allow beverages in the meeting room, but out of courtesy to witnesses, hopefully we can avoid actually eating at the table here. And number four there with the hearing request for any bills you might have, you need to get those to our committee administrator, Scott Neske. And then, let's see here, what's some basic, 50 copies of anything for bills you might be presenting. And then number seven, we'd like to try to follow the rule with the 24-hour rule on amendments. And I know this will be even more important as we get later on in session. You know, this is the committee that sees a lot of bills. I understand last time around was about 300 during the next 10 weeks. And if you average that out, we're going to be very busy. We'll add some extra committee time during probably first and second deadline week in March and maybe April. But we'd like to try to follow that 24-hour rule, if at all possible, just so everybody can have printed up amendments to look at the time we look through bills. And that's pretty standard among most committees as well. Basic stuff with turning off your cell phone, and actually I don't think cells work in this room anyway, so we don't have to worry about that. And at the end of the meeting, any materials left on the table will be recycled. If you want to keep anything, there is a section in your folder there that says items to be saved. And then the interim per diem, you know, the budgets are really limited. Chances are we will do some kind of a site visit or something, especially related to military and veterans affairs. So we have a little bit of money to work with in the committees, but that's really limited. So I guess with that, if you'd like to look through it a little more thoroughly, and then if you have any questions or comments, just talk to me after the meeting. So let's move on to the next item on the agenda here. Jim Cleary, I think the handouts just went around, and he'll give us some information about some of the things we'll be doing here in committee. So with that, Mr. Cleary.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Jim Cleary. I'm from House Research. Any day that I can help you work with veterans and military is a good day in my book. I work for this committee about half-time, and for public safety about half-time. Members, I have a packet of information here for you, and I'll go through it fairly quickly, and if you have any questions, we can field them. The first three documents are short info briefs showing what legislation was passed over the past three sessions. And this is helpful just to give you an idea of what kinds of issues have been before the legislature. It's hard to remember all the small details. But I go back to 2002 with the first one simply because that was the big budget balancing year. And it cut deeply into the budgets of Department of Military Affairs, for example, about 10%. And about 4% on a continuing basis into the budget of Veterans Affairs. There was also a bonding bill passed that year. If I could just highlight one or two things in each of these. The bonding bill that year, maybe the most significant things for veterans was that it appropriated $16.2 million for veterans' homes on the campuses, on the federal campuses of St. Cloud and Minneapolis veterans' hospitals. For homeless veterans, and that's a whole new concept that's causing some of the neighbors, at least in Minneapolis, some consternation about whether it would be for veterans or for homeless people. We can feel, but by the way, questions that you have, I may not be able to answer off the cuff, given the range of issues, but I can always follow up and get you a more detailed answer.
Thank you.
Turning to the 2003 legislature. That was a that was the beginning of the biennium, the 03-04 biennium. The tuition, just to highlight a couple of things, for military affairs, the tuition reimbursement support level had been raised in 2001 from 50% to 80%. And that's based on the cost of tuition for an undergraduate CLA program at the University of Minnesota. So it was raised to 80%. I don't know that the funding was entirely there for the 80%. But last year, it was raised to, in 2004, it was raised to 100%. The funding is not yet there for that. In 2003, it was just continued at the 80%. Also, there was an important salary continuation, a differential pay program enacted that year. It was a program that had been enacted in 1991 for Gulf War military folks who were state employees. There was a mandatory, there was a mandate that state agencies pay them the differential if they lost pay upon being called to active duty. That affected probably only about 70 soldiers at that time out of 500 or so state employees who were serving at some, probably mostly inactively in the National Guard or Reserves at that time. That program was repealed in 1996 or 7 and was reenacted in 2003 for state employees. Now, there's always been, since 1991, the authority for local governments to pay a salary differential to their activated soldiers and reservists. Some cities have been very good about doing so. Others have not. The school board actually was advising its schools that this was illegal to do, totally contrary to legislation that you had passed. So in 2003, you clarified that for them, and in 2004, I think the legislature was pretty frustrated. They mandated it for school districts. However, the salary differential payments for teachers and other school district staffs it's not limited to, but the minimum is the amount that's actually saved on that person's exact position. And there's very little salary savings when a teacher goes off to war because a long-term contract requires that the replacement teacher, the substitute teacher, be paid pretty much the same as a new teacher. And so there's very little salary savings, very little benefit for that for teachers. Turning to 2004, there were quite a few relatively small enactments last year, lots of policy enactments. One, for example, mandated that counties must reserve a family's position under a child care assistance fund if the family has been receiving that but no longer is eligible because a person's salary might be higher upon being called to active duty. Under this legislation, they would go to the head of the line and be back onto that assistance fund as soon as they're demobilized. Also, employers were prohibited from asking prospective employees whether they belong to the National Guard or Reserve. We found out that some employers were actually discriminating against people who belong and by not hiring them, particularly young people who are students on part-time jobs. And so the legislature prohibited it. However, there is no criminal penalty for that. Moving ahead to the fourth document is the Veterans Bonus Program. It's just an example of the kind of information brief we do on some of these enactments of yours. It can be very helpful to the public. We get a lot of hits on our websites on that. And when you have a constituent asking about it or you're asking about it, it's very convenient if we can go to our website and just pull up a good description. There are many more of these things I could be writing these days. I really need to put my nose to the grindstone next interim. We have a lot of veterans calling with questions asking, for example, there's a police officer in St. Louis Park who's been trying to get the city of St. Louis Park to give him the vacation and sick time that he earned while he was over in Iraq. That's a mandate under state law, and it's been a mandate since 1941. Most of us were actually unaware of it. The League of Minnesota Cities has not been very helpful, only partially helpful in getting this information out. But we need to get it out a lot more, and the state, for example, does follow that policy. The fifth document is another similar info brief on National Guard and Reserve differential pay. And then if I could move ahead here to something very pressing. The general touched on this topic. I wish he were here to hear how pleased I am with his response to this, how pleased Minnesota families are with his response to this. The general noted that when people are called to active duty under Title 10 or Title 32, most of them go off under Title 10, the state no longer has any control of them. Actually, under Title 10, the state has no control of them. That's federal active military service. But the general showed that he still does have some influence, and it may have saved some Minnesotans' lives in my own son's unit. You'll see in the photos, for example, some of the funny armor, the silly armor. You see soldiers armoring their vehicles with 2x4s and actually thinking that would provide them some protection. They quickly learned that, in fact, it can't, so they began scavenging steel parts from old tanks and so on to armor their vehicles while they're in Iraq or while they're in Kuwait on their way to Iraq. To compensate for the shortage of real armored vehicles. As you go through, you find slide 7 and slide 8 showing the actual M1114 type factory armored Humvees that do provide greater protection. And yet you'll find on slide 9 that even they don't provide perfect protection. That particular slide shows a vehicle that was destroyed by an improvised explosive device, a roadside bomb, on one of our Minnesota soldiers, actually four of our Minnesota soldiers. And in fact, one of these soldiers was the nephew of Dick Burrell, a former legislator serving last session. I never connected the dots until recently, but of the four soldiers in the vehicle, three were wounded, one pretty seriously, but they would have all been cut to shreds had it not been for this being a fully up-armored vehicle. And Dick Burrell's nephew was up in the turret, half out of the top. And because the bomb went off so close to the vehicle, it was directed upward primarily, and he was the only one in the vehicle to escape injury. So thank God that was a fully up-armored vehicle. And then the bottom picture shows three National Guardsmen from Minnesota in the same unit standing in the crater of a roadside bomb that had been directed at their own vehicle. And you'll see their own vehicles in the background. That's about how far away it was away when the bomb went off, and consequently they escaped injury. But had it been better timed, all three of those soldiers would have been cut to shreds and killed. And we're just very thankful for the timing on that. But if I could say, the generals at that time learned about this issue of the armor issue. This was last July, from the families who got excited about this, as you might imagine, and they communicated their concern to the governor, to their legislators, and to the generals. In turn, it got to the generals through the legislature. And the generals did some quiet lobbying with their counterparts in Iraq. And since that date, no one from this unit has ever had to go outside the wire, the protective wire of the airport, in less than a fully armored vehicle. And so they might very well have saved some lives here. The paper document that goes with this, it simply tries to lay out the different types of armor. House Research was asked to look into this issue at that time, and it seemed like the one contribution we might be able to make is simply to help clarify the armor issue. At that time, everything, including 2x4s, was being called armor. And so when one read the newspapers, it was totally confusing. And with some help from some of the soldiers in Iraq and others, returning soldiers, that was able to put this together, I think it makes a contribution. If I could just move on in the last minute or two to the last individual pages of your handout. There's some information. I try to read Army Times every morning and pick out nuggets of information. There's some information here about how many troops are activated today. At the peak during the invasion, there were about 2.25 million Guard and Reserve troops activated in the Army and the other branches of the military. Jumping ahead to the present time, there are about 160,000 activated for the Army. And I realize that's Army only. It's not quite apples to apples. It's more like apples to oranges. But it gives us some figures for example, that information is somewhat useful to the Department of Veterans Affairs and to House Research in the Senate in planning for a veterans bonus. Last year's legislation required them to do a study. It's largely guesswork. And we do some of that guessing based on these kinds of figures. If I could just point out, I leave this to last, the list of Minnesota military personnel killed in the Iraq War. I leave it to last to highlight it, just to remind us that this is what it's all about, this committee serving veterans and serving the military. This list was taken just a couple of days ago, but it's already out of date. I understand another Minnesotan soldier was killed Sunday, so that would be 11. If you look on the back, just by comparison, and I frankly don't know what to make of this, but Wisconsin has already had over 32, I think, soldiers killed in the Iraq War. And this might include a couple from the Afghanistan War. It does not include stateside training deaths, and the military is very dangerous, even in its training missions. My son's company, for example, lost more men in training before going over than they've lost over there so far in Iraq, and that's the real good news. And Chair, that completes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Clary. And he is located on the 6th floor, so feel free to go see him anytime, and you'll be here for any of our committee meetings that relate to military affairs. I just have a couple of brief announcements, members. In your packet is a piece of information from House Research, Mark Shepard. And then I think right behind that is information, talks about basic information on state government. If you can hold these two pieces of paper in your folder, we didn't get to that today. We're going to have Mark Shepard either present tomorrow or next week. So save these so we don't need to recopy them and stuff your folder again. And then just a couple announcements here on what's coming up. We'll have a full committee meeting again tomorrow. And it'll be presentations by administration, DOER, and revenue, three of the areas that are under our purview here. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there's no official meeting on Thursday, but instead if you can be in your office during that 15-minute segment, that would be great. And then next week, you know, we normally meet Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but Tuesday is State of the State. So no committees meet on Tuesday. So next week we'll only be meeting on Wednesday and Thursday, and we should have bills ready to go. I think there's been 9 bills referred to our committee so far, and so I don't know that we've had any hearing requests in officially, but we'll start hearing bills then a week from tomorrow. Meet twice next week. So with that, members, meeting adjourned.